Yesterday I read this list of things that I really love where a master says, talks about being willing to carry on in the path that one has chosen, truly caring nothing for material things, fame, fortune, reputation, honor, life, or death. So if you think of it, and think of how, you know, how we react to things in daily life, it would seem a pretty tall order to do that. So I want to just talk a little bit about how one does that. Because the truly caring nothing may come one day, but for most of us, we're not quite there yet. For most of us, not by a long shot. So clearly it means something other than having no feelings with regard to such things. So, you know, what can it mean? Well, it has to do with having got to the point in training where one can deliberately choose to make difficult situations one's training. One can find oneself in a difficult situation, and one can orient oneself so that one chooses to make it one's training. And how do we do that? Well, the most important question with regard to that is very simply, how do I meditate with this situation? That's the most important single question with regard to that. It's just simply, how do I meditate with this situation? And the only answer is, you know, that you get in and do it. And sometimes it takes, sometimes we do some pacing first where we're kind of getting up our nerve to do it, because whenever we're facing a difficult situation, the first barrier we hit is our own feelings, our own emotions with regard to the thing, our own emotional reactions to the situation, whatever it is. You know, think about these situations. River Master was for someone to use the words carefully. Someone, the trainee, is willing to carry on in the path that he has chosen, truly caring nothing for material things. Any material things? That's a tall order, isn't it? Can include food, sleep, you know, all our material needs, as well as, you know, more obvious objects of greed. Fame? Well, we might, most of us may not care too much for fame, but if you change it to other people's opinions of you, that makes it a lot more real for most of us. Most of us aren't having to struggle with the problem of fame at the moment. But we all want to be loved. Fortune, you know, again, you know, our security. They think of it as the material security. Most of us get pretty antsy when we feel our material security is in any way jeopardized, threatened, or at risk. Reputation, you know, what people think of us again. And by implication, you know, whether we are loved or not. More to the point, sometimes, whether we're actually hated or not. Sometimes you'd be happy just to be ignored, but it doesn't happen. No one wants to be the object of other people's malice and ill will. Honor? Now, honor is a funny one, because we all want to think that we're virtuous. We'd like to think we're virtuous, because virtuous people are the people who are loved. If you want to prove that that's the case, you know, people will do incredibly unvirtuous things if they think that they'll be loved if they do it. Also, but most of us are so educated that we, you know, that we're educated to think that, you know, doing good things makes us someone more worthy of love. Life or death, right there, you know, we all want to live. Most of us want to avoid death. A smaller percentage of people actually wants to die and would like to get rid of life. In either case, you know, to transcend these concerns seems a pretty tall order. And what I'd like to say is, you know, that you don't have to start out in the position of transcendence in order to transcend. You know, one needs to train oneself. And the difference she's talking about here between the trainee who's reached what she's calling the heart of Samantabhadra and one who has not, is the trainee who's reached the heart of Samantabhadra, the heart of active meditation, is someone who's trained sufficiently, had sufficient experience, sufficient faith and confidence that, something more than just confidence. It's actually having tried a lot of things that don't work and had tried some things that do work and having got convinced that the things that don't work and the things that do work, do work. And being able to remember, I've dealt with something like this before. I can choose to meditate with it. And then putting all one's energy and effort into the actual meditation to meditate through the difficulty. And rather than thinking that somehow we've got to be kind of struck by a magic wand to be this kind of person, which is a really unhelpful way to think. And it's a lot of people actually think and don't know it. That one day they're going to be transformed from being the kind of person who can't meditate with difficult situations, that there's going to be magic and they're going to become the kind of person who can. And it's a lot better to think in terms of, well, at times I'm the kind of person who thinks he can't or thinks she can't. But I'm always a person who can at least try. And once you allow that much light in, I'm the person who can at least try, then you kind of can bear down and focus in on, okay, so this is the difficulty, this is how I'm reacting to it emotionally, now how can I respond? And again, the key question here is, well, how do I make this my meditation? As I've said so many times, the turning point for me always comes when I can remember to ask for help. Remember to turn towards the eternal and ask for help. And then from that point, where I can kind of gather it up, whatever it is, and place it into the hands of the eternal, the wholehearted offering. Okay, so what this does... It creates some distance between you and the sense of urgency that goes with a difficult situation. There's a lovely little verse in the Bible that I quote now and then, it's a great verse, casting all your cares upon Him, for He cares for you. I remember there was a hymn that we sang when I was a kid that was along those lines. How did that go? Well, when I think of it, I'll say it, because the words are very good. And it really is true that if you think you're having to carry the whole burden yourself, then you're carrying a double burden. You only have to carry the part of it you have to carry. You don't have to carry the eternal's part too. And because, due to the ignorance and confusion from the past, from a karmic inheritance, because we don't readily discern that's the difference. What's the part that I have to do? What's the part the eternal has to do? We tend to swing between two extremes, either trying to carry the whole load ourselves and having it basically break our back, or else trying to absolve ourselves of the whole thing. And, that's the classic thing, is just to kind of retreat into a kind of a passive victim mode. Why the hell is life doing this to me? And both of those are the opposites, obviously, and both of them are unhelpful. The helpful thing is where we get in the position of the lesser partner in the two-party partnership where the eternal is the greater partner, then you've got some room to move in. It may not be very much room to move in, because some situations really are dire, and you may get cornered in a way where really, you know, no matter what you do, you're toast, so to speak. Now, we're all going to be in that situation one day. Most of us would like to live. We're all going to die one day. So at that point, no matter what you do, when it's time for you to die, and there's nothing that can be done to stop it, well, no matter what you do, you die. So the only choice you have is about your attitude at that time that you're going to take towards it. But, you know, that's a good example because it points out what the key thing always is, actually. It always is about attitude. The key thing is the attitude. To go back to the classic Buddhist teaching along these lines, is it actions of thought, of word, and of deed. And the choice of attitude is an action of thought that is so very, very important. It's from the actions of thought, of course, that all the other actions come. Now, I've been talking a lot this last week or so about the importance of stillness and the stillness of meditation. I just want to emphasize again that meditation gives you such a leg up in difficult circumstances precisely because of that stillness. And the sooner that one can go back to that stillness, when one finds oneself getting flustered, worried, agitated, swept up in feeling, swept up in emotion. You know, the sooner one can take refuge back into that deeper place within yourself, the sooner the right perspective, the perspective of wisdom, can manifest in your mind. You can't just, this is where the psychologists make a huge mistake, because, you know, the basic thing about psychology is people are trying either to, just by virtue of training their thought processes, change themselves, or by using the magic, some kind of drugs or something, that'll basically remove symptoms and magically transform you. And with regard to the real process of conversion, neither one of them does anything. That's why psychology is not religion. You've got to go to a deeper place than just running around in your head. You've got to go to a deeper place than just some magic that removes the feelings. Because it will only remove feelings temporarily. Since feeling is a reaper of karma, the feeling is going to be back. I'm not saying, by the way, that psychology has no helpful use for people. I'm just saying it's not religion. And it's especially not contemplative religion. And it's a tragic mistake to confuse the two. It has nothing to do with contemplative religion. You know, religion is about finding one's refuge within the eternal. And from that position of that refuge, everything is illumined. That which is external, which seems so weighty and so urgent, is revealed from deeper meditation as being transitory, relative to the eternal, unreal, even ephemeral. And that transformation in perspective is just the natural gift of meditating truly. I'm not saying it's not very, very difficult sometimes to find that place. It can be very difficult. And, you know, we always have to, you know, really work at accepting our humanity and trying to have compassion for ourselves and others as we struggle with this. And there is no substitute for pure meditation. There is no substitute for it. The meaning of the precepts is really just that these are the major areas in which we get drawn out of meditation. We get drawn into externals and start creating suffering. You know, willful action. The 10 precepts are about 10 essential forms of willful action. If you're not doing the willful action, what are you doing? You're holding to your center. You're keeping your spiritual balance, so to speak. You know, if we had to wait till we were the kind of person who didn't prefer approval to disapproval, we were the kind of person who didn't prefer to have a full belly to an empty belly, you know, we'd be waiting a long time. And that's just another kind of magic. Yeah, that's not what our master's talking about. You know, it's not some kind of magical transformation of ourselves from being feeling human beings to being somehow in a constant state of bliss or in some kind of state of unfeeling. It's about being a normal, ordinary feeling human being and training with it. Training with what you encounter, being that person. When I was a young monk, this is another one that Rinpoche will remember. Rinpoche Master talked constantly about grasping the will. Grasping the will. Later on, she still would talk about it, but later on she emphasized willingness more. And if the one is done right, it flows right into the other. If the former is done right, it flows right into the latter. So I'll just describe a little bit how that is the case. First of all, we have to remember that there is a middle path, or you might say a transcendent grasping of the will. Rinpoche was never just talking about willpower. Just what we think of as willpower comes under the heading of the kind of trying to carry God's part of the load. So we just say that's not going to work. And it's obviously the grasping of the will, the proper grasping of the will, isn't just kind of throwing up one's hand in despair. There's your other opposite we talked about earlier. So I always think of the grasping of the will as like going from sitting in a slumped position to sitting upright. And sitting upright as you do in meditation, not with a rigid back, and not in, you know, kind of your whole body in tension, but upright and relaxed at the same time. And that's a good example of the proper grasping of the will. You want to get a hold of yourself, get upright spiritually and grasp the will, and at the same time not overshoot the mark and kind of take it in a kind of... will take it in a kind of extreme direction where you go rigid or you go hard. And you can tell when the grasping of the will has gone too far because your attitude gets hard and uncompassionate towards yourself and towards others. any other. That's a common thing you run into in the world, isn't it? You know, that people who have learned the secret of will and haven't learned the secret of compassion. And that's not what we're talking about. When the will is grasped in the right way, you get yourself moving in a positive direction rather than a negative direction. You get yourself moving in a positive direction. And that flows right into what willingness really is. Because that positive direction is an opening to the eternal. An opening to the eternal. Opening of the heart to the eternal. And that's when the cry for help from right from the heart can come and flow out to the eternal. I have this kind of bell-like image of it because it always starts from a more confined space, I feel. It always starts in a kind of confined thing where I'm kind of rattling around between the opposites there, and everywhere I turn I feel squeezed. And then as I start to turn around in a more positive direction, then I just feel the kind of openness of the kind of opening from the chest and the upper heart towards the eternal. And then I feel then I remember, you think, well, how come this person can have been talking about asking for help all these years and years now, and heard her master talking about it for years before, and still forget to ask for help? But the truth is, I forget all the time. That's how strong a habit energy of at least one person's karma is. I don't suppose a lot of people are a lot better off than me. If they are, you know, I congratulate them, basically. And at the same time, there are some advantages sometimes, at least for oneself, in seeming to come to it the hard way, because you do learn just how helpful it is. And this opening of the heart to the eternal, well, that flows right into that offering in willingness. Offering wholeheartedly. And so on. And you have it widening and widening. And as it widens, the stillness gets greater. The sense of rootedness in the eternal gets greater. And also, that's where gratitude really flows. It's from the opening of the heart to the eternal. It's like it opens the valve of gratitude. And there is that transformation from the fear and the rigidity into the gratitude and the flexibility and the willingness. And this is not like something we got to wait to some distant future when we're incredibly enlightened and finally we get it. It's the reason why the teachings, you know, emphasize these points over and over again, is because this is what's happening whenever you're training yourself. You're working on this. You always find yourself in, you know, some position along this path. You're working at it. Was it Dogen said they travel fastest who are not there? In one of the chapters in the Shogun, that they travel fastest who are not there. It really applies here. That if you think that you've kind of finally got the truth, and you think that you finally got enlightenment, even a piece of it, then that, if you hold on to that in the least, that becomes the obstacle, you see. Because the person who's already realized the truth doesn't need to do the things I'm talking about. I mean, that's the logic of it, and we actually will follow that logic. It's not the truth, but it's the logic of a false premise, basically. Logic carried on from a false premise. That when you get enlightened, you know, basically you don't have to do the hard work anymore. And that's not true. The enlightenment is the process of doing the hard work and the perfecting of it. The doing it over and over and over again, using, it's like going up a cliff where there's all kinds of potential handholds and footholds. And the handholds and footholds are the difficulties you encounter in daily life. And that's how you're going to climb the cliff. Without the difficulties, it would just be a slick, unclimbable cliff. But this is where you get your spiritual teeth into. I'm mixing metaphors in a horrible way, I realize. You see your tooth hold on the cliff. Well, it feels like that sometimes. It's also why the Scripture Great Wisdom has those wonderful, and it can be for some people, baffling lines, you know, about no knowledge, no attainment. You know, no eightfold path even. What can that mean? It means you'll let go of what's in your head and just do it. And you'll blindly reach for that next handhold and blindly search for that next foothold. Don't cling to any real or imagined realization or attainment. After all, that side of things will take care of itself if we do the training properly. We don't have to worry about the enlightenment side of things. It'll take care of itself. As soon as you focus on it and try to make it happen, well, it just vanishes utterly.